Part 2 of our lecture on the origin of the universe. We have seen that when God first created the heavens and the earth, the first heaven, that is the atmospheric realm, was shrouded in total darkness, but completely equipped with the gases that are still present uniquely on our planet. The second heaven of outer space beyond was totally empty, devoid of any planets, of any stars at all, no sun, no moon. And therefore, the earth was shrouded in darkness because there were no light sources yet created. The third heaven beyond was populated with hundreds of millions of angelic beings. For we read in Job chapter 38, in this magnificent poetic description of God's creation of our earth, "Who hath laid the measures thereof, if thou knowest? Or who hath stretched the line upon it? Whereupon are the foundations thereof fastened? Or who laid the cornerstone thereof, when the morning stars sang together, and all the sons of God shouted for joy?" Sons of God is a technical expression in Hebrew for angels, B'nai Elohim, directly created beings, or morning stars, to use the parallel. Angelic beings were on hand. And we learn in Daniel chapter 7 and other passages that God created hundreds of millions of these magnificent incorporeal beings as His messengers and agents in the governing of His universe, ministering spirits that are sent forth now to minister to those who shall be heirs of salvation, Hebrews 1:14. Why did they shout and sing for joy when the earth was first created? Doubtless because they knew something of the fantastic events that would transpire on this planet in the future. They were on hand, therefore, in Genesis 1:1, as part of the heavens that God created, although obviously they were not visible from the standpoint of the earth. Thus, the earth was created with a cool crust capable of supporting liquid oceans, enveloped in an atmosphere appropriate for living things, shrouded in total darkness, and spinning on its axis in an empty universe. But do not science and logic demand that the solar system should have preceded the earth? Do not all leading astronomers agree that the earth had to come from the sun or from some proto-sun? If Genesis teaches that the earth was created before the sun, moon, and stars, then Christians who believe the book of Genesis are obviously in serious conflict with evolutionary theory at this point. It's for this reason that many Christians feel that Genesis must be interpreted in such a way as to avoid this conflict. After all, is it not perfectly clear from astronomical studies that the earth and the other planets did come from some primordial mass of gas and dust? It will be our purpose in the next few minutes to show that this is simply not true. By 1940, all the various encounter or planetesimal theories which postulated the near approach of another star to our sun, resulting in the drawing off of embryonic planets, had been discarded as hopelessly inadequate explanations of the origin of the solar system. In more recent years, leading astronomers such as von Weizsäcker, Whipple, Spitzer, Urey, Gamow, Hoyle, Kuiper, and others have attempted to avoid the difficulties of the so-called planetesimal theories by returning to a form of nebular hypothesis, whereby the sun and its planets supposedly condensed out of swirling eddies of cold, dark, interstellar clouds of gas and dust. How well this currently popular theory succeeds in explaining the solar system in terms of physical, chemical, and mathematical principles alone may be judged by the Christian for himself after considering some of the basic problems which remain to be solved by evolutionary astronomers. First, before any condensation of gas and dust could occur, this nebula, or vast cloud, would have diffused into outer space. Dr. Gerald P. Kuiper, a leading proponent of the evolutionary concept, admits that before gravitational attraction would become significant, the particles would have to be as big as the moon. We can't see anywhere in the universe dust condensing, and there is a vast amount of interstellar dust. Can you imagine throwing a handful of dust up in the room and seeing it gradually condense into planets? The particles simply are not big enough to exert attraction gravitationally to each other. Second, the theory demands a complex system of roller-bearing eddies of gas and dust, but this is impossible because such vortices must remain perfectly intact during essentially the entire period of planetary accretion or growth. But Dr. Kuiper confesses that, quote, it is difficult to conceive that the beautiful system of vortices would actually have been in existence long enough, even for 10 or 100 years, to get the condensation of the building material for the planets underway, end of quote. Yet, the evolutionary theory demands many millions of years. Third, what stopped the process from continuing so that the entire mass of material didn't form one large body? The Sun makes up 99 6/7% of the mass of the solar system. So what would have kept the remaining 1/7% from falling into the main body? In other words, how could we end up with 9 planets that are distinct from the Sun? Fourth, other suns do not seem to be condensing or developing planetary systems. There is much interstellar material in the vicinity of our sun, but it's not condensing. Dr. Greenstein of the Mount Wilson Observatory is of the opinion that the known stars rotate so fast that one must conclude that they could never have been formed by a condensation process. Professor David Laser, professor of astronomy at Harvard University, says that there is no known solution to the problem of the small angular momentum of the sun. That is, the property that keeps the sun rotating and keeps the planets revolving around it. If it had been part of a gaseous proto-galaxy, its angular momentum would have to have been a billion times as much as it now possesses. How it could have lost all but 1/10,000,000 of 1% of its original angular momentum has never been explained. You will find Dr. Laser's article on this subject under the heading Cosmogony in the McGraw-Hill Encyclopedia of Science and Technology. Fifth, the planets contain less than 1% of the mass of the solar system, but a staggering 98% of its angular momentum. David Bergamini, in the Life Nature Library volume on the universe, observes, and I quote, "A theory of evolution that fails to account for this peculiar fact is ruled out before it starts," end of quote. In the sixth place, evolutionary theory cannot explain why 7 of the 9 planets have direct rotation in reference to their revolution around the sun. But Venus rotates slowly backwards, and Uranus rotates at a 98-degree angle from its orbital plane, even though its orbit inclines less than that of any other planet. In other words, it's only in recent years that we have discovered that while almost all the planets spin in the same direction that they orbit about the sun, Venus spins backwards while orbiting forward, and Uranus spins almost horizontally, sidewise, as it moves in its beautiful orbit about the sun. Professor Laser of Harvard states, quote, "It is an open question whether this state of affairs is consistent with current theories of the origin of the solar system." No one can imagine, for example, how these planets could have been bumped and thus have their rotational direction reversed. Can you imagine the momentum of these enormous masses of matter suspended in the vacuum of outer space having their direction suddenly changed without being totally destroyed? On the basis of a gyroscope or a spinning top, the forces involved are almost beyond imagination. In the seventh place, evolution has no answer to the problem of retrograde satellites, that is, moons that orbit backwards around their mother planets while the planet orbits forward around the sun. Of the 32 moons in our solar system, 11 are orbiting in directions opposite that of the rotational direction of their mother planets. Of special interest is Triton, the inner of Neptune's two moons, which has nearly twice the mass of our moon, its diameter being 3,000 miles, and which revolves backwards every 6 days in a nearly circular orbit only 220,000 miles from Neptune, closer than our moon is to the Earth. Dr. Isaac Asimov, as well as most evolutionary cosmogonists, believe that Triton was, quote, thrown away from that planet by some cosmic collision or some other accident, end of quote, and that later on Neptune recaptured its lost moon into a retrograde, backward orbit by a, quote, similar accident, end of quote. This is from his book, The Intelligent Man's Guide to Science, Volume 1, page 78. But how many such accidents may one be permitted to invoke to prop up a theory already tottering under the weight of its own unproved assumptions? Dr. Asimov further states that retrograde satellites are, quote, minor exceptions, end of quote, to the general rule of satellite orbits. However, 11 out of 32 moons having retrograde orbits can hardly be brushed aside as minor exceptions. 8. What can evolution really offer as an explanation of the angular momentum in these satellite systems? Let's permit Professor Laser of Harvard to state the problem. Quote, except in the Earth-Moon system, which is exceptional in other respects as well, the mother planet, the primary, carries the bulk of the angular momentum instead of the satellites, the moon. This circumstance aggravates the theoretical difficulty presented by the slow rotation of the sun. For if the sun has somehow managed to get rid of the angular momentum it would be expected to have, according to the nebular hypothesis, why have the planets not done likewise? End of quote. 9. In spite of some ingenious and very complicated theories, it has never satisfactorily been shown why the Earth is composed of such heavy elements. In the words of Professor Fred Hoyle of Cambridge University, and I quote, apart from hydrogen and helium, all other elements are extremely rare all over the universe. In the sun, they amount to only about 1% of the total mass. The contrast with the heavy elements which predominate in the Earth brings out two important points. First, we see that material torn from the sun would not be at all suitable for the formation of the planets as we know them. Its composition would be hopelessly wrong. And our second point in this contrast is that it is the sun that is normal and the Earth that is the freak. The interstellar gas and most of the stars are composed of material like the sun, not the Earth. You must understand that cosmically speaking, the room you are now sitting in is made of the wrong stuff. You yourself are a rarity. You are a cosmic collector's piece. End of quote. In other words, our planet, with its heavy core of nickel and iron, cannot be explained as to its origin in this universe. We might add, as a final point, that the atmospheres of the planets are all different from each other and from that of the sun. Venus, has an atmosphere of carbon dioxide. The Earth has an atmosphere mostly of nitrogen and partly of oxygen. Jupiter and Saturn have atmospheres of methane and ammonia. And nobody really knows why and how these planets came equipped with such unique and distinct atmospheres. All of which illustrates a basic point in our analysis of the evolutionary theory. Namely, the more you know about the facts, the details, the less you can take seriously the evolutionary hypothesis. Evolutionism thrives best in a realm of low visibility as we move away from facts and fill in the blanks with our human speculation. The most rational way to explain the origin of our vastly complex solar system is in terms of a direct creation by God. And if this is a reasonable position within the revealed framework of biblical theism, in view of the conspicuous failures of evolutionary alternatives, may not the supernatural origin of the astronomic system that we know the best, namely our own solar system, serve as a model for the supernatural origin of the stellar systems that lie beyond our own? We know that our solar system could not have evolved. It had to be created. And therefore, it is highly reasonable, knowing as we do the omnipotence of our God and something of His methods, as revealed in the Bible, to insist that the whole universe beyond was created directly by His Word as a dynamic functioning entity, like the Earth and the other eight planets and the Sun and the Moon. In other words, if God created ex nihilo, the two great lights that rule the day and night, He could also have created ex nihilo, the stars also. In the words of Dr. Paul Zimmerman, quote, "The biblical account of creation by Almighty God has not been disproved by science. It remains today, even from the viewpoint of reason, the most logical, believable account of the beginning of the earth and the rest of the universe." End of quote. Why did God create the sun, moon, and stars on the fourth day rather than the first day? One possible explanation is that in this way, God has emphasized the supreme importance of the Earth among all astronomical bodies in the universe. In spite of its comparative smallness of size, even among the nine planets, to say nothing of the stars themselves, it is nonetheless absolutely unique in God's eternal purposes. It was on this planet that God placed man, created in His image and likeness, to exercise dominion and to worship Him. It was to this planet that God came in the person of His Son, 1900 years ago, to become a permanent member of the human race and to die for human sins upon a rugged cross. And it will be to this same planet that this great God and Savior will return again to establish His kingdom. Because of its positional superiority in the spiritual order of things, therefore, the earth was formed first, and then the stellar system, just as Adam was first formed, then Eve. Another possible reason for this order of events is that God, by this means, made it clear that the earth and life upon it do not owe their existence to the greater light that rules the day, namely the sun, but rather to God Himself. In other words, God was perfectly able to create and take care of the earth and even living things upon it, fruit trees included, without the help of the sun. Apart from the scriptures, of course, this would hardly be an obvious fact to mankind. In ancient times, and even in some parts of the world today, great nations actually worshipped the sun as a god. In Egypt, he was called Re, and in Babylon, he was known as Shamash. The Aztecs, at their great temple of Teotihuacan, worshipped a sun god and offered human sacrifices to sustain and please him. After all, such worship seemed quite reasonable in view of the fact that the sun provided light, warmth, and apparently life itself. Even the Jews were greatly tempted to enter into such worship, as may be judged by such passages as Deuteronomy 4:19 and Deuteronomy 17:3. And even Job, that great patriarch of old, frankly confessed, "If I beheld the sun when it shined, or the moon walking in brightness, and my heart hath been secretly enticed, or my mouth hath kissed my hand," that is, in secret homage or worship, "this also were an iniquity to be punished by the judge." Why? "For I should have denied the God that is above." Job chapter 31, verses 26 to 28. Job was surrounded by sun and moon worshipers in his day. You say, well, at least nobody does that in the civilized world anymore. Are you sure? Perhaps it's not inappropriate to suggest that the evolutionary theory provides a modern and subtle counterpart to the ancient sun worship cult. Even though men do not bow down before an altar dedicated to the sun in a temple with priests, we have to face the fact that in all of our science textbooks dealing with ultimate origins, in all of the classrooms of our great universities, we find scientists boldly asserting that we can trace our origin to the sun or to a proto-sun, and if we live, move, and have our being exclusively through its boundless blessings and provisions, then it is our God. The creation account in Genesis completely undermines all such blasphemies by putting the sun in a secondary position in reference to the earth. It's not only a creature of God, but also a servant to man, the crown of God's creation. But if the sun, moon, and stars are not ultimately essential to the earth's existence, then why did God create them? Why didn't God keep the original system of simply one light source somewhere in the universe in reference to which the earth went through its night-day cycle? Three basic reasons for the creation of our present astronomic system are listed in Genesis 1:14. They are for lights, for a calendar, and for signs. As lights, they replace the special and temporary light of the first 3 days and shed light at night on man's pathway as well as by day. As a calendar, they are greatly improved over the first system, because now we have, with the sun, the moon, the planets, the stars, a calendar that can divide seasons, days, and years, and even centuries, and enable men to plan their work accurately to the distant future to accomplish God's purpose for man on earth as originally intended. And as signs, they teach and ever remind men of vastly important spiritual truths concerning the Creator. They are not there to frighten men like UFOs that supposedly indicate the hostile intent of intelligent beings on other planets or in other worlds. They're not for astrology to determine for us what we will do tomorrow or the next day, or whether or not we were born under a lucky star. No, in Jeremiah chapter 10, verse 2, we are warned, "Fear not the signs of the heavens as the heathen fear them, for they are afraid of them." No, God didn't create them for that purpose. David learned from the heavens the transcendence of God in his own comparative nothingness. "When I consider thy heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained, what is man that thou art mindful of him?" Psalm 8, verse 3. Psalm 19, "The heavens do what? Declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork. Day unto day showeth knowledge. Speech is heard in a voiceless manner as the message goes out day and night concerning the glory and wisdom of God." The Apostle Paul insisted that men are utterly without excuse for their idolatries, for the things that are made give clear testimony to the everlasting power and divinity of the Creator. Romans 1:20. Apparently, the sun, moon, and stars more effectively accomplish these purposes than one great light source could have. There need be no other reason for their existence than this threefold ministry to man. But, you might ask, would this not have been an unnecessary waste of God's creative energies to create all these billions of island universes and galaxies just for men to look at? The answer is given in Isaiah, chapter 40, verse 28. Hast thou not known, hast thou not heard, the everlasting God, Jehovah, the creator of the ends of the earth, fainteth not, neither is weary. There is no searching of his understanding. God simply spoke, and the universe came into existence. It took no more work for God to create a billion galaxies than to create one planet. In fact, as David put it, the heavens are the work of God's fingers. God spoke, it was done. And when they have fulfilled their God-intended purpose, these heavens with all their suns and moons will flee away from His face and no place will be found for them. Revelation 20, verse 11. The eternal city will have no need of the sun or moon to shine in it, for the glory of God will lighten it, and the Lord Jesus Christ will be the lamp of that city. Revelation 21, 23, and Revelation 22, verse 5. It is Christ and His Word, therefore, that must be our final guide as we seek to understand the origin, the meaning, and the destiny of the heavens and the earth.